Hello and welcome back to the show, my AOWs. Thank you so much for tuning in to a brand new episode today. I'm so excited to share this episode with you. So today I have Dr. Chautman. She is an obesity medicine specialist, and we met when she joined my course, the How to Prescribe and Manage HRT with Confidence and Ease course. And she also came to speak to my private Facebook group for my patients. And I just loved what she had to say about the endocrine disruptions and how there's so many parallels to the endocrine disruptions in perimenopause and menopause. So you're going to absolutely love this episode if you are like the millions of women who find that you're so frustrated with the weight that you're gaining through perimenopause despite good diet and exercise. She's really going to get into the physiology of why that happens and why we feel that way. I am so sorry that I didn't get an episode out last week. I was on the Pause Life Cruise with Dr. Mary Claire Haver, as well as amazing clinicians, Dr. Vonda Wright, Dr. Corinne Men, and so many others. We had an amazing, amazing trip. And it just really made me realize how important this work of spreading the message about what is happening to our bodies in perimenopause and menopause is. Besides for that, I've also been a very busy bee. Today, I had documentary film producers here in my house. You can follow them over at Balanced DocuSeries, and they're doing a whole docuseries that they hope to pitch and sell to a huge, huge, huge network to reach thousands of women about the message of how women have been mistreated, misdiagnosed, misunderstood through the perimenopause to menopause transition. And if that weren't enough, I am also expanding my telemedicine private practice. And I could not be more excited. You know, I have been at this for a really long time. I love taking care of women in midlife and menopause. And I truly, truly, truly wish that I could be everyone's clinician, if that's what you want. Maybe it's not, but I wish that I could. There's just not enough of me. And I have trained the most amazing, caring, kind, sympathetic, wonderful clinicians who are now seeing patients alongside me in my telemedicine practice. So if you've wanted to see me as a patient in either I haven't been in your state or maybe I've been out of reach, I now have new providers in different states as well as nurse practitioners in some of the states that I'm already in as well. And we now have just an array of options, choices, and clinicians and states and just so much. When you book a visit, you also get my free course that I teach. And that's like a 6 to 8 hour class, as well as if you would like our private Facebook group where I come and talk to all the patients in the practice. There is so much going on behind the scenes. I have so much excitement and energy. 2024 is going to be the year, mark my words. All right, without further ado, let's get into this episode. If you want to learn more about the clinic, check the links in the descriptions of today's show notes. Hi, and welcome to Health by Heather Hirsch, a podcast dedicated to uncovering many of the women's health issues many of us are wondering about, but few of us are talking about. My mission is to expose the current gaps in knowledge and care on all things women's health. Enjoy. Well, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today, Case. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Heather?
I'm wonderful. Actually, we're kind of smiling on camera here because we have had a lot of different talks this week. And thank you for coming to my provider Facebook events group. And we had a great conversation just a few days ago. And I have to say, for those of you who listen to the show, it was really fun for me to listen to someone else speaking. It's, you know, for better or for worse, I'm doing a lot of teaching and talking, and I love doing that. But gosh, it was so fun to just listen. And so we talked about weight loss not being, willpower not being enough. You'll kind of run through that. But anyways, so I'd love to give you the chance to just introduce yourself to my listeners on the podcast, a little bit about your background, and we'll take it from there.
Well, awesome. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I am so excited. Love to kind of brainstorm, talk about anything weight related, obesity related, perimenopause, menopause related, because they're so intertwined, aren't they?
Yeah, and a lot of parallels. Yeah.
Yeah, super. So again, my name is Dr. Kaysa Troutman, or Case Troutman. I am a triple board certified obesity medicine, culinary medicine, family physician. I have a brick and mortar practice in Pennsylvania, in Camp Hill, which is right in central Pennsylvania. But I do see patients via telemedicine, you know, as long as they are currently in Pennsylvania at the time of the visit. I recently opened my practice. My practice is official. Oh, I don't know the official, but it's probably like 3.5 months recently opened in just,
Amazing.
yeah, mid-September. So it's very exciting.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
Yeah, we were
yeah.
just talking about how it's fun, and medicine is just changing so much, you know, the practice of medicine, what patients are looking for, just so much is changing. It's cool. It's fun.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I had left prior to opening my practice. I was a medical director at integrated health system, and you know, for various reasons, decided to really jump off that proverbial cliff. And as you know, how all the it's both terrifying and exciting at the same time. But again, love what I'm doing, and yeah, excited to share my knowledge in weight or anything that your patients or our viewers are interested in.
Amazing. Well, I'd love to start with, you know, you kind of opening up with your story of how you got interested in culinary medicine and obesity medicine. These are important topics, and it's amazing to see, even in the last few years, but really even in the last year alone, the advances and the new ways of understanding how our bodies change, right? We could call it weight medicine or weight management, but I think that that diminishes very much what is happening. Meaning there's changes in adipose tissue and deposition and metabolics and, how we break down foods and proteins, right? So anyways, tell us, how you got into being interested in this yourself.
Yeah. I just like anything, I think that we are passionate about, it's an intertwine between professional and personal, I think. So for me, it really started with my own journey. You know, 2017, 2018 was my pivotal year where I was at my highest weight, and I don't even know what my weight was because I, you know, refused to get on the scale. And I know you probably can't tell, but I'm 5'0". So
me too. I'm 5'0" also. 60 inches right here, I think, something like that. Yep.
Right. So that 5'0", that's a big deal when it comes to weight. So I was at my heaviest. So at that time I was, you know, I was desperate. It's a mixture of I was desperate, I was upset at myself. I'm like, my God, I'm like a doctor, you know, I'm smart, I'm talented. Why is it that I cannot lose weight? Or actually, I should actually better qualify it as, why can't I keep the weight off? Because I have had that weight loss when I was on point, you know, when life was great, when I'm motivated, when I'm not super stressed, I could follow a diet, I could follow an exercise program, and then life would happen and I would quote unquote fall off the wagon. And I just, and that was for me, that year was like, that's my highest. So it was pivotal. We're like, okay, Case, like, you got to figure this out. So hence started my own journey on finding out what should be the right way to eat. How should I do this? So, and with that, I learned the science of obesity medicine. And really the message that I always share with my patient when it regards to weight is, it is not just about willpower. Like our title of talk is it's not just about mustering our willpower, because it is not just about calorie in and calorie out, which is how we've been taught, how I was taught, you know, in medical school residency. And I think that thought is still very prevalent, not just in society, but even like providers, you know. So, and we know now that that old calorie in, calorie out model is a very incomplete model. So we're not saying it's wrong, it's just incomplete. It's not showing the whole complicated picture, right? So with obesity medicine, we recognize that weight is, I like to use the, you know, a symphony of different factors. Absolutely, it's about what we eat, you know, and absolutely, it's also about how we move our bodies, but it's also complicated by our psychology, the hormonal dysregulation, how we sleep, if we're stressed, so many, and genetics, you know, so many factors. So it's not as simple as that, you know, which I think that's the message that we're really trying to kind of share. So it's not as simple. And number two, there's treatment and strategies that can be done to help this condition, this medical condition, because that is what it is, you know. The other change I think lately is the fact that it is not just like it is a medical condition, because there are effects on our health, both that contribute to weight and how weight affects certain medical conditions. So
Yeah. What is the where did this whole so I know you mentioned the whole calories in versus calorie out. Let's kind of stick on this debate for a second because my gosh, this still seems to be a little bit of a debate, at least on my Instagram feed. And I want to kind of know from the your perspective. It's not just calories in, calories out. If it's not, as your stance on the argument is, what else is, dive into what else is a makes up a part of this whole orchestra of players that kind of cultivates in our appearance and what we weigh and where fat deposits. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so I would say how I always kind of explain it to my patients is maybe just the idea of energy in and energy out, right? And let's start on the energy in kind of side first. So energy in, of course, it's what we eat, but it's interesting, right? It's not just what we eat, but how is it absorbed, right? So is it all absorbed? Is it all or absorbed, aka or deposited? Is it deposited as adipose tissue straight away? So there's so many like factors that affect just that input of energy. So with that input of energy, that is actually where insulin resistance can come in as well. That's also the quality of the food we eat. So for example, I'll just throw in like fiber, right? So fiber is literally something that your body does not actually absorb. So it just goes through the gut. In there's data that it doesn't because if you have a high fiber food, that actually changes how your body absorbs what we eat. So
Interesting.
that's the introduction of energy part, and then the expenditure of energy. You know, this is where factors like muscle mass comes in, factors like did we sleep? Did we, or how stressed are we? Several studies actually have shown that, let's say a patient that doesn't get enough sleep, there's actually a decrease in variety of factors, including satiety, increase in the hunger hormone, and even just how your body kind of uses up the energy. So, yeah. So hopefully that was not as confusing as I thought it
Yeah.
was.
And how do we now know, of course, there's lots of medications out on the market, right? There's semaglutide, which everyone probably has heard of. And if you haven't, a semaglutide is something like Ozempic or Wegovy or Mounjaro. And these are weekly injectables that are really changing the game in terms of effective treatment for weight loss. And so what I'm learning and learning from you is that these medications are going to impact that hormonal pathway. So tell me more a little bit about that.
Yeah, so before we dive into the medications, I just maybe want to step back a little bit, just so that your listeners or viewers don't just think it's just medication. So when we think about helping patients in their weight struggle or weight journey, our emphasis as obesity specialists is really looking at what we call the four pillars, right? So we look at nutrition, we look at physical activity, we look at behavior change, especially factors involving stress and sleep management and the medication, right? So those are the four pillars. So medication is one of the tools that we utilize, because the medications are what make it that it's easier for us to stick to the changes that we encourage our patients to do. It's easier for us to stay within the nutrition plan. It's easier for us to not overeat. It's easier for us to, feel satiated. So it is a tool. It's a tool in the toolbox because it helps increase the, likelihood of continuing the plan. So I'm sorry, and I digress. And the question was, how does it affect their hormonal regulation? Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So, because I think it's interesting, and I definitely agree, not like just jump right to medications, but I think their mechanism explains and validates a lot about how there are these hormonal pathways that are, altered. I don't know if that's the right word, which making this not just about willpower.
Right. And the basis really, when we think about it's not about willpower, is why does weight happen, right? So a lot of the times when we think about weight and hunger, the first organ that we think about is my stomach, right? That's what I first think. But now we recognize that the obesity is actually is related to changes in our brain, So in our brain is actually I always call it the master regulator. So it's a master regulator of hunger, of satiety, of that drive for cravings, and so on and so forth. So these medications that are available now, for example, semaglutide, which is marketed as Wegovy or Ozempic for diabetes, one of the effects of this medication is it works on a particular hormone called our GLP-1. And GLP-1 agonist, it works on the part of the brain that actually so it decreases hunger in the brain. So it's interesting when my patients are on, for example, this medication, I hear a lot this statement of, wow, this is how it feels to not be thinking about food all the time, or which we call like the food chatter. Like they would tell me, "Man, oh my gosh, Dr. Trauman, this is the first time I am not obsessed with food, or I am not thinking about food all the time."
Right, food noise. People will say noise has turned down.
Exactly. So very it's so empowering for them because for the first time, the food does not control their thought. Like, and usually the way they would present it before is like, I would just eat lunch and I'm thinking about dinner, so that doesn't happen as much anymore, which is good. And so hence, if we control that hormonal dysregulation, right, then they'll be more likely to eat their protein, eat their vegetables, drink their water, and not veer off to cravings. So that's, again, that biological kind of drive there that's making it harder.
Yeah. How long has it been since, the idea of calories in, calories out was something I always learned. I definitely grew up learning that. And how long has it been since we've really understood these hormones? And how long has it been since we've been able to discuss this with patients? Because the thing about calories in, calories out very much places the onus on the person, and therefore it really does make them feel like they continue to fail because they obviously must be, overeating and they can't maintain that deficit. And they're hungry too, right? So kind of help to fill in the gaps for me, even though I'm a physician and I can understand this. It does seem like it's new, but is that just because we're just now talking about it? Is it kind of like menopause and that the pandemic pushed a lot of people to discuss this more on social media? What do you think is happening?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I would say, I think right now, the idea of, again, calorie in, calorie is still prevalent, right? I mean, literally, I actually have patients that tell me that their primary care doctor still tells them to eat less or whatever. Yeah, provider would, somebody would still give them the statement of you should just eat less and move more. So I believe ghrelin was discovered in, oh my gosh, I wish I prepared. It's somewhere in my head. I think it's like 1980s or something like that, that it was discovered. So the idea of ghrelin or the hunger hormone has actually been around for a while. But I guess in terms of utilizing it in clinical practice and being able to disseminate that information, I would say it's just recently with the advent of all these GLP-1 medications, because we're seeing the effect that, like, clinically, we're seeing the patients say, I'm not as hungry.
It really
And
is interesting.
for sure. And it, you know, oh, I was there something in my head. I totally, like, I don't know what I'm gonna say.
I mean, I'm just so fascinated because I don't remember. I mean, I don't remember learning about these hormones in medical school.
Nope.
Although,
Agreed.
not to say that I remember everything from medical school, because it was 2006 or seven. So,
Oh,
I mean, I
you're
think we're going
showing
on
your
like,
years.
but I don't remember this, and I think it's so pivotal in the way we think about obesity and thinking about it more as a chronic condition and things that are, not just that women, or I say women. Not that just women have struggles with weight, of course not. That's just what I'm used to saying. But that it's not just about willpower. My question is too, I see a lot of women who say that if they have a male partner of the same age and they're both going on a diet, it seems that men have an easier time losing weight, especially postmenopausally. Do you think that has anything to do? What do you think about that? Before I even bias you with what my guesses are,
Yeah.
is that really real? Is that really true? And if so, what are some of the reasons behind that?
Yeah, so clinically, I actually have seen that. In terms of the reason why that is, I actually don't have any, like, clinical, evidence-based data to say why it is. My kind of, reasoning or deductive reasoning would be maybe has something to do with the muscle mass. Men
Interesting.
usually have a lot more muscle mass than women. And to me, that may be more why it's easier for them to lose weight than females. That's kind of my two cents. But yeah, it's a good point. And I mean, I have definitely seen that in my practice, because sometimes in my old practice, I would have a husband and wife team, and they'd be doing eating the exact same meals because they were preparing it, and then, like, the husband would lose. So I think it's predominantly more muscle mass. But you can enlighten me if there is some hormonal differences. Yeah,
I
I'm
don't
curious.
know. I mean, I really don't know. My guess has kind of always been, or at least my explanation that makes sense to me, is that, and I'd love your take on this, is that estrogen and insulin kind of have like a good thing going. Like they're kind of friends and they kind of keep each other in check or something like that. Because one of the things that we notice is that when women go through menopause and their estrogen declines, that's really when they have the most insulin resistance.
Yes,
And
for sure.
that could just be a coincidence. However, in the women's health study, we've found that women who use estrogen as hormone therapy, supplement estrogen, have less progression to diabetes. And we know that men make more testosterone than women, and they continue to make their testosterone throughout their lives, and that converts to estrogen. So that's kind of always been my backdoor theory,
Yeah,
right? But I
yeah.
don't know, is there anything else that maybe backs that up, or you're like, I agree, but I'm not sure. I mean, there's no direct proof of this. It's really hard to see, we can't really exactly really see what hormones are sending what messages to different cells and really get to that cellular basis. So I don't know. That's always kind of been my thought.
Well, there's definitely some data now out there about postmenopausal women and why it's, like, harder for them to lose weight. I am just not aware of the comparison between, men and women. But for postmenopausal, what the current evidence, and I say current because, my gosh, this field is just exploding, right? We've known, I think we'll know a lot more in, like, 2 years than what we know now. I always tell my patients, like, I know a lot, but we're learning new things every day. But
Every day.
yes, for sure. So the data right now in terms of why patients are in the perimenopause or menopause stage have a harder time with weight is primarily, number one, a decreased muscle mass. Again, I think after our 30s or 40s, there's certain percentage that we lose of our muscle mass per decade, and that seems to be accelerated as in the older age. Number one. Number two is that insulin resistance. So, the way I explain it to my patients is, menopause is like reverse puberty, where instead of depositing the adipose tissue in our hips, it's actually depositing in our abdomen, which is that a fat deposits in our abdomen. That is the fat that is actually more metabolically unhealthy in a way, which is that's and again, when we say metabolically different, that's the one that causes inflammation. So segue here. So did you know that adipose tissue or our fat tissue is not just a storage form for energy? It actually is an endocrine organ, where it is, it's an endocrine organ that secretes inflammatory cytokines. So that's why we know losing just a little bit of weight creates such a huge impact in their health, because just because of the inflammatory markers that decrease,
I think it is interesting that we know that it's not just a storage unit. It is an endocrine gland, or it's making hormones like other endocrine glands do.
Secreting
Do you?
hormones, secreting transmitters, secreting like inflammatory markers.
Yep.
So,
I mean, I think it's fascinating. Just again, there's so much more that we do know now that we didn't know
absolutely.
before.
So,
What
going
is
back to that, so I just want to complete that thought. So, one was decreased muscle mass. The second was that insulin resistance. So, again, that insulin resistance happens because of the fat depositing in the abdomen, or what we call our visceral fat, which is more, again, highly inflammatory. And that deposition in the visceral fat, that's increases the likelihood of insulin resistance. And then the third, what they found is actually is sleep. So again, especially if they're having hot flashes, right? So sleep is disrupted, and disrupted sleep can create that cortisol dysregulation, which then affects insulin resistance. Oh, by the way, it affects these other hormones. So again, whenever I talk to my patients about what are the hormones that affect weight, I like to talk, there's so many, right? But I always like to talk about the top four, which is the ghrelin, which is the hunger hormone. Leptin, which is the satiety hormone, insulin, which kind of dictates how energy is stored, and cortisol. Cortisol kind of affects all of the three. And I think if you put these four hormones in the context of menopause, for example, right? So the insulin resistance is part there, and then the cortisol is when sleep is disrupted. That can affect the weight. And what's interesting is affecting cortisol will it's like a cascade, right? If cortisol is kind of off, and when cortisol, I always tell my patients, it can get off when we're not sleeping, when we're overwhelmed, when we're stress, general stress. That can actually make us hungrier, like literally signals the ghrelin to be higher. It makes the leptin lower, so we're less satiated, so we're more kind of snacky, and insulin resistance. So they're all kind of connected.
You know, do we have anything like we need like well, I'm kind of joking, but not. I'm just kind of learning from you, and I love this, but like we need like we need to give ourselves some leptin, right? If we gave ourselves leptin, would we be less hungry? And the only reason I'm kind of thinking as I'm saying it sounds sort of silly is that of course the hunger is important. We should be hungry. And in fact, appetite and hunger are, do give us dopamine, right? They are joys of life. We all know that when we get a cold and we can't taste, we're like miserable because we miss tasting our delicious food. But are people looking into the future not just with semaglutides, but of other ways of sort of turning some of these hormones into pharmaceuticals, whether they're agonist or antagonist, meaning they're blockers of something like ghrelin, or they're agonist, or they're acting like something like leptin.
Yes, actually, so what's interesting, and I should have kind of mentioned that earlier, was they actually did that, and I can't remember the study where they gave, tried to increase the leptin levels, and it did not create a weight change because of something called leptin resistance. So a lot of us know about insulin resistance. So there's the data now is actually it's not that you don't have enough leptin. You may have enough leptin, but it's actually you have that leptin resistance. So leptin resistance basically is you still feel hungry even though your body has enough stores or adipose stores. So just to kind of clarify for anybody listening, right? So ghrelin is a hormone secreted by our stomach or gut, and that is again literally a signal that says feed me, I'm hungry, right? And that sends a signal to the brain. Leptin is a signal that comes from the adipose tissue, going to the brain that says, I'm full, let's stop eating, or that satiety hormone. So leptin resistance is the signal is being sent, I'm full, let's stop eating, but it's like not kicking in, So there's more data now that it is actually more of a leptin resistance. But there's no way to test for it. Do you know what I mean? For leptin resistance.
What is your leptin level and what is normal and what is mine? So let's move to, I was really eager, selfishly, to ask you about all these hormones because, I think hormones are so fascinating. I'm kind of sort of a pseudo endocrinologist over here. But let's talk about real things in terms of if patients are or not on semaglutides or are not on medications. Certainly knowing if it's not just calories in versus calories out, and there are hormones, you've already touched on a couple of things that we now know are important: muscle mass and sleep. And so what are some of the practical things that you can tell the listeners now that we know it's not always just about willpower, because we've got these hormones that are controlling, hunger cues and adipose deposition. What can we do?
Yes, and so many things, actually, so many things. And this is the beauty of the art of medicine, and or specifically obesity medicine, because there's so many levers. I call them like little levers that we can kind of like adjust to kind of create the result that we want. So and again, if I kind of, I always go back to my four pillars whenever I discuss it. So let's say with nutrition, one thing I always ask my patient to do is try and hit a certain protein goal, So at a mi my minimum, so minimum, it really goes up higher depending on the patient, their height, their weight, male or female. As long as their kidney function is normal, I usually say a minimum of 60 grams of protein. So protein is one of the signals that can actually lower ghrelin, right? So I always thought when I talk about hormones with my patients, remember hormones, we can't control it, right? We can't say ghrelin, go down.
Go to your room.
Ghrelin, stop acting up. So we can't, but we can create strategy, or we can influence the things that signal the, or I should say that affect that hormone. So protein is a very strong, lowers the ghrelin. So that's the first thing, And ideally trying to do it before your typical kind of hunger. So when I have my patients kind of look back and kind of tell me how their day went or what was the struggle, a common theme would be, I'm like snacking right before dinner. Let's say dinner is at 6, and they say, man, Dr. Trauma, as soon as I get home from work, 5 o'clock, I'm like starving. I can't stop eating. So my question always to them was, what'd you have for lunch? Right? So we always look at the meal before. Because if the ghrelin, if let's say super busy, like I don't know about you, Heather, but for me sometimes like breakfast, lunch, unless I make myself, stop and pay attention, and I have to eat. Sometimes we skip it, right? So very common. It's so common nowadays. But so if we so ghrelin goes up. Let's say breakfast, we skip breakfast, ghrelin will be going up. We skip lunch, ghrelin will be going up. Yeah, 5 o'clock. Yes, yeah, super high now, right? So, and it's so much higher, so much harder to lower that ghrelin when it's at that high level. That's why we're like starving, feed me everything, right? Versus if we were, let's say you had breakfast, that ghrelin will go down. And then you're going to be hungry again. And then, you know, so it goes back to a more manageable level. So protein is the one. And then the other thing, and then from a nutrition standpoint that helps would be making sure we have our fiber. Fiber will help fill up our stomach, get sense that signal back to the brain through the vagal nerve that we're full. The other thing that helps with is second, just throwing out some examples with the second pillar would be physical activity, right? So especially patients that struggle with insulin resistance. So we know movement actually, or exercise or any movement of choice actually lowers insulin resistance. So I thought one of the, for my patients that struggle with activity, or it's just not something that they naturally do, or I would just say, hey, can you take a 10-minute walk after, I don't know, dinner? And that 10-minute walk, that actually will lower the insulin resistance, because what happens is when we walk, so our that's utilizing our lower extremity muscles, which are big muscles, right? So even if you don't like run, just walking. And then the muscles are like a sink for glucose. So you're, because they need glucose to function. So they get the glucose from the blood, and it's being utilized. So the glucose gets out of the bloodstream and into the muscles. So it would lower our sugar in the blood, basically.
Yeah. I thought that was so fascinating. And you know what? I don't know why I find this funny, but walking is a lot harder than it seems. And the only reason I say this is because truly, actually, this is just my own self-projection. And, you know, I used to be a runner, and you always kind of, and I think women do this, we always think that whatever we're doing is not enough. If we're just walking, that's not enough. I don't know why, or if this is just me and I am struggling to get out of this vicious cycle still. But, you know, walking is it really has so many benefits, right? Tell
For
me if
sure.
I'm wrong. I think it's also something that's really sustainable, and we have to get out of this rut again, specifically me, it sounds like, of thinking that, you know, taking a 1 mile walk is not worthy.
Right. I think it's also about expectations that we set for ourselves. So I think for somebody, if I think if you're used to that high, right, from working out with high intensity, and you get that dopamine high, you may not get it with that walking. So you don't feel like I'm doing anything, but any little bit helps, you know, any little bit helps for sure.
I think you're right. I think you hit it on the head there, is that expectation, you know, when I get home from a run, I'm usually, oh, I'm so sweaty, and you know, it's kind of like when you go to the steam room and you feel all, you know, like, you
I pop.
And you take a shower. And then when you go on a walk, you're like, huh, you know, there's definitely not an adrenaline kick, at least at this point. But I might be meditating while I'm walking instead of getting that dopamine high, right? I'm listening to some, maybe I'm listening to some more of a news podcast, versus if I'm running, I'm trying to listen to more, you know, music with drums and beats, so I can kind of do that. So it's a different experience.
I think it depends on expectation and where we're beginning. And I always think from a physical activity standpoint, there are seasons, you know, we have seasons that we are like, I'm a runner. There are seasons where maybe, you know, whatever, like, where the activity could be different. And, you know, I recall one of my patients, I'm so proud of her. She was one that, you know, very sedentary, kind of like most of us, in front of a computer, and, you know, started out by just going for a 5-minute walk. And then when I saw her a couple of months later, you know, it was like, oh, I'm walking like 2 miles now.
That's
Which to
amazing.
Me, oh my God, 2 miles. That's awesome from someone that would not walk because stuck to the computer. So it's really that 1% change, you know, that 1% change that creates, you know, the big change eventually. So
What are your thoughts on, so we talked about some, I guess I'm going a little bit backwards. I was going to ask about your thoughts on intermittent fasting. You talked about protein. Do you have any preferences on timing of eating? Sorry, this is again just a little bit out of order, so I can tell that I'm thinking, but what do you think about that at all?
Yeah. So intermittent fasting, right? So the so even now in this in the obesity medicine world, it's you will have people that are pro fasting, people that are not pro fasting, and these are all experts in their field having their own kind of statements and studies to prove one versus the other. So there are evidence-based articles for this side, there's evidence-based articles for that side. So
Yeah.
I'll give you my two cents.
Let's have it.
So for me, from what I understand and what I've seen is intermittent fasting from helps from a weight loss perspective, it helps because it will, under the nutrition tab, decrease the caloric intake because we have a shorter eating window. Okay. But intermittent fasting has significant effects on our metabolic health, which sometimes they can be different, meaning a person can initiate intermittent fasting. They may not lose weight, but their A1C gets better. Does that make sense? Yeah. So in terms of intermittent fasting, I always kind of start with that statement where, for weight, it's new, it still is the then it's neutral. And I'm sure somebody can refute me with an article because there are articles out there that will say, no, it doesn't. Where was I going with this? I, however, don't think fasting is not for everyone in the sense that if they are fasting and then they notice during their eating window they are ravenous, they are eating the pantry, and there are patients that do that, then it's not a good fit. That means that they, especially if there's a history of a binge eating disorder, it would not be my first recommendation to do IF or intermittent fasting. Having said that, I will tell you, I actually fast myself. I do intermittent fasting personally. I've been doing it for 4 years now. So I usually do the 16-18, which is the more popular. So, or I should say 18-6, 16-8, however you want to, calculate that. There are so that's the most popular one is that 16-hour fasting, 8-hour eating window, which you can do, every day, you can do every other day. Then the other one, we call it the 5-2, where patients would fast for, would be fasting for a certain amount of hours on 2 days, or I keep mixing them up because I don't normally endorse the 5-2. So I think it is a good tool to use in the right patient. I think your question was, is there a right time, right? I think for me, it's how the patient, you have to match it to the patient's lifestyle. I think, so where do they naturally do that? Where does it naturally come easier? Because we want to make sure that it is not as hard for them. I always tell my patients, in the nutrition plan, there is no one great diet. And they've actually done studies on that. They've done studies on low carb versus low calorie versus low fat, yada yada. Which one creates the most weight loss? And the answer is whatever the patient can stick to at the end of that study. So for example, if they're normally not eating, till like 10 a.m., then their fasting or their eating window could be 10 to, I don't know, 6 or 7 or 8, Yeah, so how I normally would recommend to patients too is, what time do you normally eat? What time do you normally stop eating? What time do you normally start eating? And then wherever that is, hey, maybe start by an hour difference. So don't let if they normally have an eating window of 10 hours, for example, I wouldn't tell them to do an 8-hour window. I'd say, hey, why don't you start a 9-hour window? Like that. Slow change.
And then I agree. then when it comes to, you know, sleep, I know I bounced around with diet and sleep, so please excuse me. You know, that's
the most, so many issues with that, right?
Right. Exactly. Right. I was going to say, that's where my job is, right? So much of sleep gets disrupted because of perimenopause and menopause. And I cannot stress enough, you know, I always, tell the story about how, 3 days after, 3 days away on like a work trip by myself, even though the work trip was still kind of stressful. I had left my three kids for like one of the first times and got three beautiful nights of sleep. And wow, I just felt so much better. What is actually sleep doing on metabolism? Like, we all inherently know, yes, sleep sounds like it should be right, but I've got an obesity medicine specialist with me. What does the sleep actually do for that metabolism? How does it actually seem to rev it up?
That's a good question. And I'm trying to pull it out of my head right now. So what I can remember right now is that, you know, sleep, when we don't have enough sleep, it does bump up the ghrelin and decrease the leptin. And I remember this one study where people that normally sleep 8 hours, in the study, they made them sleep 5 hours. So a decrease in the actual sleep time. And then they checked their ghrelin and their leptin. And the ghrelin went up by 15%. This was after a couple of days. So you're like, literally, you were hungrier 15% and you're less satiated. And the this happened at the same time. Hunger hormone went up, leptin hormone went down. So that is the effect of 3 hours of sleep difference.
Wow. It's hormone. It's hormonal again, right?
It is hormonal.
It's hormonal.
Yeah. Wow. In terms of metabolism, for some reason, I can't get it out of my brain right now. Same thing. And there was some data that decrease in sleep, insulin resistance was a major factor as well. But yeah, I'm blanking on the output side. Remember how the input and output for energy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I, you know, wrapping up, because I know we've been talking for a while, but this is so exciting. I think the updates in this type of physiology and the hormonal connections, it's so fun to actually, for me, really get to learn. I've been doing my reading and, you know, staying up to date, but to really sort of ask conversational questions and learn from you has been nothing but a pleasure. Remind me just again, where could they find you if they want to work with you?
Yes. So again, I practice in central Pennsylvania. I have a brick and mortar office. I will see patients via telemedicine as long as they are in Pennsylvania. So if you are interested in getting obesity expert help, please go to my website, www.weightremdy.net. For anybody that's interested in becoming my patient, I actually do a 15-minute video meet and greet, just so you can kind of see me, chat about, you know, my philosophy about, again, the four pillar foundation. Really, my goal with my patients is, you know, health gains through weight loss. Because ultimately, that's the goal, you know, being healthy.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for your time today. Thanks for coming on the show and teaching me and all my listeners so much about this field of medicine. And thank you guys so much for listening in. I couldn't thank you more. I'm so grateful for being able to have this platform and get all this information to you. I'll see you next week for a brand new episode. Bye, everyone. Thank you guys, as always, for listening to this show. If you love the show, you're going to love my new book, Unlock Your Menopause Type. This book is really meant to help you identify and target and therefore best treat your most bothersome menopause symptoms. In the book, I go through all the different ways menopause can be treated with HRT, of course, non-hormonal therapies, and diet, exercise, and lifestyle. You can get the book anywhere books are sold. And if you are so inclined, please leave a book review wherever you bought your book. I will absolutely be thanking you. I hope you enjoy reading it as much as I enjoyed writing it. If I haven't already done so, thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for listening to my show. Consider subscribing so you never miss an episode. Also, if you love the show, your stars or a quick review could really help other women who are searching for information on menopause and midlife around the globe find this show. If you want to work with me, consider the Reclaiming Menopause Masterclass. The link for that is in the description to this show. Thank you again from the bottom of my heart for all your support, and I'll see you next week for a brand new episode.